I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are live on the Heritage Radio Network. Today, we're talking to Danielle Nierenberg. Danielle is the president of Food Tank and an expert on sustainable agriculture and food issues. Danielle has authored or contributed to several major reports and books, including Happier Meals, Rethinking the Global Meat Industry, State of the World, 2011, Innovations That Nourish the Planet, Eating Planet 2012, Food and Agriculture, the Future of Sustainability, and Food Tank by the Numbers Family Farming Report. Welcome to the show, Danielle. Thanks for coming on. This is your maiden voyage on this particular program, isn't it?
It is. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, thanks so very much for not canceling today, since I know you're under the weather. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thanks again.
So since you are a newbie to this program, why don't you tell us a little bit about Food Tank? What is it and what are your goals?
So Food Tank is a fairly new organization. We're about to turn 2 years old. And the mission really behind it is to cultivate individuals, organizations, and original research and content to push for food system change. We really try to bridge both domestic and global food issues and show whether it's, you know, hunger and poverty in sub-Saharan Africa or obesity in the United States, they're really part of the same issue and the same problem, a food system that's broken and that's really focused on calories rather than really nourishing people. And so what we try to do is really highlight stories of hope and success in the food system and inspire eaters and businesses and policymakers to really, really change the food system and make sure that, you know, it's fixed, that it's not broken.
Cool. So you have your first annual summit for Food Tank is coming up on January 21st and 22nd in Washington, D.C. And this is in partnership with George Washington University. Is that right?
It is. Kathleen Merrigan's Office of Sustainability and Food Tank have partnered to bring together 75 plus speakers over 2 days to really hash out what the future of the food system can look like and really, again, highlight those stories of hope and success.
Fantastic. And so I'm just going to run through some of the topics that you guys are going to address, and let's talk about some of them more than others. But starting with cultivating better urban food systems, what do you mean by that? Do you mean like urban gardening, or are you talking about getting food into food deserts, or what's that about?
Yeah, it's about all those things. How can we make cities not only centers of food production, but how, you know, also how we can help people access safe, affordable, and justly grown and prepared food. So we're really excited that Mary Che, who's a member of the D.C. Council, the City Council, will be speaking and giving the keynote. My good friend and who's someone who's been a good mentor to me, Dennis Dimmick, who's one of the editors at National Geographic, will be moderating. So we're really excited to have farmers and researchers and policymakers all on that panel talking about, you know, how to make food systems better in urban areas. You know, there are 1 billion urban farmers worldwide, and a lot of them are doing it as a hobby, but millions more are really doing it out of necessity because they need better access to affordable food, and the only way to do that in some places is to grow it yourself.
Wow, and so that's, I'm considering that those other million plus are not necessarily in the United States. I mean, I've been following the urban farming movement here pretty closely, and it's certainly nothing like those numbers. So where is that happening the most, do you think? Is that in like sub-Saharan countries?
And It's really all over. It's Latin America, it's Asia, it's Sub-Saharan Africa. You know, I've had the opportunity to visit Nairobi, and one of the largest slums in the world there is called Kibera, and anywhere from 700,000 to a million people live there. And everywhere you look, people are growing food in empty lots, in you know, containers on the tops of their roofs. You know, they're really growing as much food as they can because they don't always have access to it, and it's since 2007 and 2008, when the food and financial crisis began, never really went away. Food prices really still remain high for a lot of people, so they have to grow their own food to get the nutrients they need.
Right. Well, those staples still, I mean, even though corn has come down in price, I think all of the other ones have stayed pretty close to the numbers that they shot up to during that crisis.
Yeah, and it's some people are paying as much as 80% of their total income on food, you know, yeah. And for comparison, the United States, we're paying anywhere from like 7 to 10% or lower. Right. And so, you know, that's a huge chunk of your money going just for food and not considering any other necessities.
Right, right. Crazy. So next up is food waste. I've had Dana Gunders on this program at least once, if not twice,
nice.
Talking about, yeah, I do a lot of stuff with the NRDC. So I understand from her that we waste over 40% of the food that's grown in the United States. And actually, last week I had a guy on who has a brand new composting system called 4Solutions, where they can compost in 5 days. So I'm all about the food waste, food composting thing. Tell me about who's going to be speaking on your food waste panel and what's your goal there?
We have some great people. Ben Simon, who was just named one of Forbes 30 Under 30 social entrepreneurs, he founded and is the director of the Food Recovery Network, which works with universities and colleges across the country to collect food that would otherwise be wasted and distribute it to those in need. They have, you know, for the food scraps and the things that cannot be, you know, eaten because they've gone bad or whatever, they also are establishing composting systems at universities so that they can be used for school gardens.
Right.
But, you know, composting is sort of the last resort, right? So we're talking to folks like Jean Busby at USDA, Patricia Benecki at the United Nations Environmental Program, and folks from the Food Marketing Institute to really prevent that waste before it happens so that, you know, it doesn't just not, compost is very valuable and it's
sure.
a great way to use food scraps, but we want to make sure that the labor and the resources, the water, the soil, the inputs that go into growing food don't go to waste and make sure that, you know, either consumers are better educated about use by and sell by dates, which I'm sure you've talked to NRDC a lot about, but also that farmers have the infrastructure they need to preserve their crops so that they don't rot or get eaten by vermin or are susceptible to mold or pests and disease. So it's a whole range of things that really need to happen. I'm really excited to have such a diverse set of speakers on that panel. You have, you know, sort of the international side. You have folks like Mike Curtin from DC Central Kitchen who will talk about what they do to, you know, get food and serve it to their clientele. So I think it's going to be really interesting. It's one of the panels I'm most excited about.
Oh, is that right? Well, I look forward to it. I'm really interested in that concept, and I do think that the idea that we raise all of this food and then put 40% of it into landfill is pretty discouraging. But a lot of that also has to do with educating the consumer, Danielle, don't you think? Because, I mean, for instance, when you're a produce grower, whether it's fruit or vegetables, if your fruit doesn't look perfect, you can't send it into a market. I mean, and the French have adopted a system of, in some places, of using ugly fruit and selling it. And when are we going to start doing something like that? Is that part of the discussion
you know,
here?
It's funny because I think a lot of farmers markets here in the United States have been good about marketing that ugly fruit concept. If you talk to organic farmers of fruits and vegetables, often their produce looks a little funky. And
they,
you know, I know a lot of farmers have been very good about, you know, it tastes just the same and offering samples to consumers. Intermarché, which is the grocery store you're talking about in France, has really taken on this issue in a big way. They offer these ugly fruits and vegetables at a lower price. They're
right.
educating the consumer. But a lot of it, I mean, I think we have all sort of been duped. We've lost our culinary skills, so we don't really know what proper portion sizes are anymore. So we overcook food or, you know, we cook too much of it. We don't trust our senses. We look at those expiration and sell-by by and use by dates, again, you know that those don't mean a lot, and right. they can vary from store to store and state to state. We've forgotten to trust ourselves. Like, if it looks bad or smells bad or is a little bit slimy, probably you shouldn't eat it. But, you know, if it looks okay and smells okay and then tastes okay, you're probably going to be fine.
Right.
You know, so folks just need to sort of trust in themselves again, and I think that takes relearning, you know, culinary skills, cooking skills. We've lost all these home ec programs
yes.
in high schools. I think we just need to sort of relearn some of the skills that have been lost. I wish the Cooking Channel and the Food Network would take on this issue, too, because so many people are watching food as sort of a spectator sport.
Absolutely.
And if we could use those forums to really teach people about really practical things, I think we'd make some headway.
Well, I think the Cooking Channel was an attempt to go back to that earlier format of Food Network actually being a teacher. But I'm not sure how successful that is. But you've hit a button that I touch on a lot, which is the fact that people have lost the ability to cook for themselves or recognize that cooking for a family, if you can just even allocate a couple of hours a week, you can go a long way towards making meals really easy and quite cheap and not have to stress out about food or buy food from outside, you know, prepared foods from outside sources, which is, of course, the source of much of our dietary illnesses, right? I mean, obesity,
Absolutely.
Extra salt, extra sugar, that all comes in foods that have been prepared for you. So, you know, in a way, when we talk about, I'm just going to go off on a tangent here, but in a way, when we talk about the broken food system, which, by the way, is a phrase I'm coming to really detest, but I recognize that there are problems with it. I don't think it's broken. I think that it just is doing what we no longer want. But when it started out, like in the 50s and 60s, when mm-hmm, all of this mm-hmm. got rolling after the war, and women were not so much in the kitchen, you know, we wanted those convenience foods. We asked for cheap food. We asked for all of these things. We got them, and now we're pissed off because we're fat and unhealthy. Well, I think that I think the answer is, you know, largely what you said, which is to bring culinary skills, home ec skills, and shop skills back into the high school education. I think that making a premium on, making fruits and vegetables more available to everybody who needs them at a price point that is affordable. You know, all of those things are part of it. But I think it's unfair to cast the food system as it exists in this, in this sort of villainous light, when all they have done is make money for their shareholders and deliver us the food that we wanted, which was cheap, fast, and convenient. End of my story now. Sorry about that. But you know what I mean? Like, don't you feel like it's time to talk about real solutions and engage with them as opposed to like having, because like one of the things you talk about here, the family farmers creating resilience in the food system. And like, I love the idea of family farmers, and actually most like agricultural livestock ag producers are family farms still. Their access to the consolidation of the industry, the livestock industry anyway, has been a real impediment to them. So do you
Absolutely.
See, when you talk about family farmers building resilience, what are you actually saying there? What does that mean?
I think, you know, in a lot of ways, we've ignored the family farm. There are 500 million family farms, small and large, around the world. They're producing more than half of the world's food, nearly 60%. There's a lot of opportunity for them to regain control of the food system. I'm sure you've talked to many farmers who, you know, started off, you know, their grandparents were small family farmers, but as the years passed, they got into contract situations,
sure.
you know, either through the livestock industry, or some of these other big, you know, conglomerates. And the only way that they could get loans and insurance for their farms was to be part of those systems. And I think, you know, they're not a lot, you know, if you talk to a lot of these farmers, they're not happy doing what they're doing,
yes.
but they don't have a choice. And what we need to do for family farmers is give them the choice that they had before and take away some of the impediments that have forced them into these systems that they're not, you know, they don't even consider it farming.
Right.
And I think, you know, the Farm Bill made a small push for that, with giving, you know, more assistance to, you know, small and medium-sized vegetable growers and fruit growers. Mm-hmm. But we need to go a much longer way so that farmers don't feel trapped, whether they live in Malawi or they live in Iowa. We need to make sure that farmers are, you know, have the resources that they need, and that all of the money, you know, again, whether it's in Africa or the United States, doesn't go to the big consolidated farms, whether right. they're family farms or not. We need more investment in these small and medium-scale growers who are trying to do the right thing but are often forced into systems that they didn't want and didn't agree with.
Yes, I would agree. But I think that, that there the story is how do you aggregate their product? How do you pack it and ship it and distribute it? I mean, that to me,
and that's
the thing that I see,
and absolutely, and that's why food hubs that are springing up all along the Northeast are so important. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they'll spring up in other areas. You know, the growth of farmers, unions, and cooperatives and, you know, advocacy groups for young farmers especially, I think can help change a lot of this. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen overnight, though. And we need more policymakers who are interested in these small and medium-scale growers in Congress and in parliaments and, you know, in boardrooms all over the world.
Yes, I agree. I mean, hard to argue with that, Danielle. I mean, it does come down to policy, though, doesn't it? I mean, it really does, because until...
So much of it, yeah.
Yeah, until government on either the state, local, or federal level gets behind this idea, I don't think we're going to see a lot of change. And that's... Well, in our second half of this program, we're going to talk about lobbyists for a minute. But I want to just quickly keep going through these issues that you guys are... Because you really did a great job of, like, corralling what I see as the big... You know, the big kahunas when it comes to changing the food system. Then you have the story of food. I'm assuming that's just food writers. I know you have some
it's
great
people.
It's
not just food writers,
that.
But food communicators. And, you know, people who are, like Frank Sesno of Planet Forward at George Washington University, they're using video. They're using, you know, social media. They're really trying to teach students how to tell the stories of farmers and the land and the landscape in different ways. And I uh-huh. think that's so important. We talk a lot about, you know, as farming populations age worldwide, the average age of farmers across the world. It's 58.3 years of age. Uh-huh. You know, we also need to grow other careers in agriculture, and I think an important part of that is the storytelling. It's people like Roger Thoreau who traveled throughout Africa and really talked to farmers and tried to understand, you know, their daily lives and communicate that through his books. It's people like Vicki Robin who are incredible storytellers. Eric Hoffner from Orion Magazine, which is this is what he does. He writes about the food system. So
I know.
Really,
he's my main man.
Right. And then, you know, we put a policy person on this panel who's a former classmate of mine from Tufts University, actually, who works with the Baltimore City mayor. And really, what do policymakers need to hear, and how can they communicate what they're doing better, too? So it's communication on a lot of different levels. And I think it's important because, you know, as you mentioned before, we really need to reach the people who are making these decisions in their kitchens and at their dinner tables each day. And yeah. how do we do that? We have to, you know, have a cohesive story about why, you know, cooking, you know, for your family is important, why buying from farmers markets is important. And if we don't have that story together, then we're not going to make the change that we need to see.
Right. You're not saying that you think that everyone is going to end up buying from farmers markets, though, right?
No, and I don't even think that's practical or necessary.
Right.
But I think what we need to get is people thinking about where their food comes from again mm-hmm. and making decisions based on that sort of transparency that's out there, that, you know, they know how it was produced, they know where it came from, they know what it supports.
Right.
And whether that's farmers markets or your local co-op or Whole Foods or your Safeway or whatever, just having the information you need to make better buying choices.
Right, right. I think that's true. Now, the business of food. You have one of my friends on there, Brad Nelson, who I met when I went to Australia last summer.
Nice.
I think he's great. Just one of the smartest people I've ever met, hands down. I mean, just
I agree.
Love the guy.
I agree.
And he
is...
No, Vice President of Culinary for Marriott Hotel Corporation. So tell us about that panel, The Business of Food. What do you think Brad and his ilk will be talking about? What are they saying?
I think Brad will discuss sort of the limitations that big hotel chains like Marriott and others really have, but the work that they're trying to do is so important. You know, Brad was on the forefront of pushing for more sustainable seafood options at Marriott and, yes. and really pushing for, you know, things in the 1990s before this was on anyone's radar. So the power of business in this world, in the world of food, is really, you know, it can have it be a big force. And I think, you know, Brad, because he's sort of, you know, more conservative than a lot of other folks on that panel, will have yeah. a lot to say. But I think, you know, where he's on the same page is this need for businesses, both small and large, to make better decisions and to push for sustainability in whatever way they can. It's not always going to be practical for some of these large corporations, right. but when they can do the right thing, you know, I think, you know, I hope Brad would agree with me that that's their responsibility. They need to be doing that, pushing for more sustainability, because that will trickle down, you know, to some of the smaller businesses. And I, you know, again, when you have such a large clientele, there's a real opportunity for education and communication. Yes. And I think Marriott has done a great job at that.
And it's a great way to differentiate yourself from other people who share your market. If you're a hotel chain and you're offering sustainably raised, you know, whatever. Or, you know, Marine Fisheries Stewardship Council approved fish or something like that. That's a way of differentiating yourself in the marketplace.
Absolutely.
And the other thing
Absolutely.
I want to say is, like, you know, this, I mean, to me, the institutional buyers are the ones that we really want to target in terms of really moving the system, because they have the buying power. And so a few weeks ago when the Urban Food School Food Coalition came together and those five or six big school districts said they're not going to buy chicken that has been raised with prophylactic antibiotics, that was a big issue for the Poultry Council. You know what I mean? The Chicken Council kind of didn't, you know, they were like, wow, that's huge. And you're basing
right,
this on
absolutely.
What? You're basing this on a study from Harvard that just came out, which I'm going to send you, actually, Danielle. You should read it.
Fantastic.
Recognizing workers in the food system. This is a big topic right now with the wonderful work that just came out about the Immokalee food workers. Of course, I'm blanking
yeah,
on the name.
Chains.
Food chains.
Food,
thank
food
you.
Chains. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a great documentary. But I think there's been a lot more sort of recognition of just what these people are contributing, right? And then, so what are the issues you're going to talk about there? Will that be like immigration, wages, social justice?
Absolutely. And talking about the range of workers in the food system, it's not just farm laborers and farm workers, it's restaurant workers.
Right.
And you know, a lot of the people who are working in packing plants and distributing food, they, you know, they need to be recognized as well for, you know, the sacrifices they're making, the low wages that they're getting, and the unfairness that they get, whether it's, you know, because they're undocumented or, you know, not able to essentially feed their families. These are the people who are serving and growing and preparing the food that we eat each day, and they can't afford enough to eat. So
well,
I mean,
I
really getting
that.
At those issues.
Yeah. I mean, I love that we subsidize McDonald's by, you know, by giving, you know, by paying their workers benefits in this form of Medicare and food stamps. I think that's just amazing.
Crazy.
Talk about a scam, right? I mean, outrageous. Okay, moving on. Pushing for better agricultural research and policy. Boy, have you hit a nerve with me. This is one of my favorite topics. Can't wait for this panel. I think that agricultural research is so corrupted by corporate gifting that it basically might as well just not exist. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been co-opted by, you know, some of the biggest agriculture companies in the world. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do get back is public interest research, interested in the research of the public and in the interest of farmers. And I think what will come out of this panel is a lot of different things. One, the need for more participatory research practices that really involve farmers from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, researchers and aid agencies going into to communities and telling them what to do or what they should do, and instead just asking them what they need, what kind of agriculture do they want, working with farmers from the very beginning and farmers groups and getting at the nitty-gritty of what these communities really needed. And I think, you know, having Jerry Glover from USAID, who also worked at the Land Institute, his work on perennial crops and really working with farmers who are developing these perennial crops, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia is going to be really exciting to hear about.
Yeah.
We have, you know, a great lineup, including one of Food Tank's board members, Nabiha Kazi from Humanitas Global and the Community for Zero Hunger, who, you know, this is what she does. She's, you know, every week she's in Vietnam or Mexico really talking with policymakers and farmers and researchers and getting at sort of the crux of what people need to do their jobs better. What do these farmers need?
Right.
And I think, you know, having this group of folks sort of debating this issue will be really interesting.
Now, are you going to be including sort of climate issues and how agriculture is going to be changing over the next few decades as the planet warms, continues to warm up? Is that part of this, or is it really
Absolutely. Jerry will be discussing some of that in his remarks. Also, the family farmers panel will be talking a lot about that. We decided not to have a panel exclusively on climate change because we think so many of these issues encompass that anyway.
Yeah,
I mean, it's sort of the overarching, this is what we're all thinking about all the time. So I think it'll come up in several different panels.
Great. We're pushing for international agreements. That's global trade agreements. What's wrong with what we do now? What kind of agreements are you looking for?
this panel specifically will focus on this new international charter called the Milan Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that it calls for is the end of food price speculation, the fact that we're treating food as a commodity and not a human right.
So you're going to take, you're going to take corn, rice, soy, et cetera, off of the commodities exchange market? Is that what you're thinking?
I'll look forward to hearing what these panelists Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot that can be done. And again, you know, treating food is a human right. And I hope these panelists will really, you know, sort of debate that issue and not talk about it in terms of just dollars and cents, but really getting at, you know, if we can end food price speculation, you know, as the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Olivier de Schutter, talked about during his tenure as the rapporteur, we could really solve a lot of the problems. We could, you know, make sure farmers are getting fair prices. You know, we could, end hunger. We could end this up and down of food prices that's taking place in the developing world and really solve a lot of the issues that are most urgent right now, especially for the poor in developing countries.
Absolutely. I mean, just thinking about, weren't there riots about the prices of rice in the Middle East and a few years ago? It was because of the commodity market.
Right. It was the start of the Arab Spring. I mean, what happened in Tunisia was over food prices, and that spread all across the Middle East. So, you know, looking at a lot of these issues, it's not only about solving the issue at hand, but it's about sort of the side effects. It's the conflict that erupts. It's the environmental degradation that results. It's all of these other things. So if we can get to the crux of some of these problems, we'll be, you know, there will be all these benefits that we can't even understand right now, but you know, there'll be these side effects that really benefit farmers and eaters and businesses and policymakers.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so next, I'm sorry to rush you through this, but we do only have 45
minutes.
So.
I know, and I'm talking a lot.
No, it's good. I want you to. I mean, I'm talking too much, so I'm glad that you're able to like just talk right over me. Do that, please do it. True cost of accounting in the food system. Another good hot button issue for me, which is to demonstrate the externalized costs of raising so much corn, for example, right? So it's like...
Absolutely. We're not counting the externalities of the kind of food that we're producing right now. We're not counting, you know, the public health problems and costs. We're not counting the environmental costs. We're not counting the impact on workers and animals. You know, there's so much that's not seen at the price we pay at the checkout counter at the grocery store. And I think, you know, having this group of scientists and business people and advocates is going to be really, really interesting. Patrick Holden from the Sustainable Food Trust in the United Kingdom is coming all this way just to be on this panel. And
wow.
He's just been such a leader on this issue. So really having him there is a coup for me. He's one of my many heroes in this movement. I think he'll have a lot to say.
Well, I really appreciate you inviting all these groovy people so that I can then invite them on my radio program. And then I look cool, too.
Awesome.
So... But also, I mean,
I did my job then. That's my job.
That's right. But to speak to the true cost of accounting, I just want to remind listeners that, for example, right now, Des Moines, Iowa is, struggling with terrible water quality issues, as did Toledo, Ohio earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we're talking about, because we're talking about the runoff, the industrial runoff, either from industry or from ag, that is causing these giant algae blooms, these dead zones and so forth, including the giant dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which has been explored on this program several times in the past. So I won't go further, but that's what we're talking about here when we talk about the true cost of accounting.
Absolutely.
It's like these people
Absolutely.
Have got
and we're
to
also
pay.
Talking about obesity and diabetes and heart disease.
Oh, yeah, right.
And all
that
of the
stuff.
Other things that come from this, you know, really messed up food system. There's a lot that can change. There's a lot that can be done. But we're really, you know, we need to get this accounting right so that we mm-hmm. can get the pricing right.
Yes.
And so people really understand what they're buying.
Absolutely. Okay. So last but not least is democratizing innovation. What does that mean? I didn't even understand what
so
that was.
So this is something that we recently got a grant for from the McKnight Foundation. And the idea is to explore how innovation happens, how it's replicated, how it's scaled out and not necessarily scaled up. And how farmers, again, we're getting back to the participatory side of this. How can farmers and researchers and aid agencies and governments all be talking to one another from the very beginning to determine what are the best innovations, not necessarily technologies, but the things that are going to help improve communities and give them access to markets or, you know, help them build better infrastructure, help them find the right crops that are appropriate to their particular needs, their climate, their environment.
Yeah.
And it's a really big, broad topic, but one that I think, you know, this is what Food Tank does. We try to spread information. We try to spread it to, you know, a range of stakeholders, whether it's regular eaters like you and me, policymakers, businesses, the funding and donor communities. So really just exploring how the use of information can spread these innovations, you know, not just from north to south, but also south to south, having communities talk to one another. You know, I spend a lot of time on the ground, as I think you know, and, you know, you'll see a great innovation happening in one community, whether it's rainwater harvesting or, you know, growing different indigenous crops. And just a few miles down the road, another community is really suffering because they don't know about what this other community is doing. And so how can you increase, you know, the spread of information, whether it's through information and communication technologies like the internet and cell phones and cell phone apps, or, you know, having better communication among farmers groups so they're meeting face-to-face. There's so many different components of this. Mm. So I think it'll be really interesting. It'll be an interesting conversation, especially with someone like Steve Brescia from Groundswell International, whose organization is working in 7 different countries. And this is what they do, too. They try to help farmers find the best sort of agroecological solutions that are most appropriate for their communities and for their lifestyles and for what, you know, they need in you know, in that particular village or city. So I think it should be a great conversation. I'm really honored that Jill from Stone Barns can come and participate. Jessica Rosen from Forum for the Future is going to be a great contribution to the panel because she's working on with a range of stakeholders from businesses to farmers to really hash some of this stuff out. So I think it should be really fun.
Oh, it sounds absolutely great. Okay, so now, Jack, we can take a sponsor drop. Sorry, Danny, but we have to take a little sponsor drop here and celebrate Tabard In. And we'll be right back with Danielle Nierenberg from Food Tank to talk more about the issues that are going to be coming up at her food summit, January 21, 22 in D.C. Stay tuned.
I tripped. I was in the
Today's break song is called Lazy LA by Odetta Hartman. The following program has been brought to you by Tabard In. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and on the phone with me is Danielle Nierenberg, the president of Food Tank, which is hosting its first annual summit coming up January 21-22 in Washington, D.C. Danielle, so let's talk a little bit about engaging with industry, because after all, these are the guys who currently run the system. And one of the things that over the last 6 years that I've been doing this program, or some variation thereof, I find that there is this tremendous polarization, and it's not just because, you know, people on sort of quote unquote our side don't like these people on their side, but they also see our efforts to change the food system as deeply threatening. And actually, I think that is the source of a lot of sort of the polarity that I see when I'm talking to both industry groups, you know, industry groups and advocacy groups. And I think that, you know, you especially at Food Tank are kind of in a position to be addressing some of that. And I wondered if you have made any outreach or initiatives to big industry leaders to talk about what you see as kind of the you know, top five issues of how to address the stuff that's giving them all the bad press. I mean, you know.
Yeah, like, absolutely. I mean, the advantage of Food Tank is that we're seen as non-biased and kind of agnostic in this space. We're obviously environmentalists. We're pushing for, you know, things that protect the environment in terms of agriculture practices. But I've worked very hard over the course of my career to maintain this agnosticism, if you will. And that's why, you know, I can sort of flip between different groups. You know, I can show up at the World Food Prize in Des Moines, Iowa, and then, you know, attend a food sovereignty conference, you know, somewhere else. And I'm you know, sort of seen as someone who, you know, thinks about these things in a kind of fair, unbiased way. You know, and I do, if we ignore a couple of things, if we ignore industry, then we're never going to make the change that we need to see in the food system. I mean, that's just, you know, it's the truth. And I've had the opportunity to engage and or be on, you know, boards or advisory boards for a couple of different companies, including the Unilever Global Advisory Council for their Sustainable Living Plan. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think, you know, Unilever is one of the biggest companies in the world, right? They're making consumer products. They're making food products. It's a real opportunity for nonprofits to have an influence. And we do. There are only 6 members on this Global Advisory Council. We're all, you know, environmentalists from all over the world, and we can make a real change. We get the opportunity to talk to, you know, Paul Pullman, the CEO. We get an opportunity to talk to the people who are on the ground working, you know, on palm oil issues with Unilever. Uh-huh. And really press them for what they're doing and get the answers that, you know, are going to, again, make change and make change for farmers. I was brought on because of my, you know, belief that if we're not talking to small farmers and medium scale farmers, then none of these changes that businesses are trying to implement are going to take hold. We really need to be working from the very beginning with small and medium scale farmers to make sure that they get the resources that they need. So I think if you're not engaging with business, then it's all for naught. And it's just like if you're not engaging with policymakers and the research and development communities, and if you're not engaging with farmers groups, then none of this is going to work.
Yeah.
So we have to be talking to everyone. We just do. And, you know, for a long time I was, you know, very resistant to engaging with business and engaging with industry. But the older I grow and the more you sort of see how the conversation around food is changing, you have to make any change. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them. It doesn't mean you have to take money from them, but you do have to engage with them.
Yeah, I'm right behind you, honey. I mean, I've been saying that all along. It's like, if you can't play with the big boys, then you're not playing. I mean,
it really is absolutely that simple. Absolutely.
So let's go on and talk for a second about the economics of fixing the quote unquote broken system. Changing the system requires massive differences in financial allocations, whether they are from the industry in the form of revamping their current production models or their infrastructure, or from consumers who might have to pay more for better food. So how do you sell that program to either industry or consumers? Because that's a key part of this.
I mean, on the consumer side, you know, it's very simple and very controversial for me to say. But, yeah, food is going to be more expensive. And that means all of us need higher wages. We need to raise, you know, the minimum wage to a wage that people can actually live on so that they can buy food that, you know, farmers can sell at a higher price. I mean, that's the reality for me. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk, you know, especially from the Obama administration and some of the big corporations about the need for public-private partnerships. I'm not necessarily opposed to these arrangements where, you know, whether it's Monsanto or Syngenta are working to, you know, increase infrastructure in developing nations. But we need some better strategies. You don't want just the Monsantos or just the Syngentas part of these public-private partnerships. You need more sustainable businesses, smaller and medium-scale size businesses to be engaging on that level too. And I think, you know, a lot of the focus has been, you know, through the World Economic Forum and other sort of high level international organizations has been, you know, let's focus on the big industries and let's get them working with farmers. We need a better system to get smaller, more sustainable companies engaged on that level, and we haven't done a good job at that.
Right.
And then, you know, what you were talking about before, the industry has such influence in Congress and in other governments that we need to get the lobbyists out of this. And I don't know how that's done. It's not like I have the answers to this, but we need to figure out a way where this corporate influence is not as big as it is right now, because it's messing things up. And it's not allowing the change that we need to see happen. And I don't know, again, I don't have the answer, but we need to figure something out that allows, you know, more open, transparent discourse so that we know who's funding things and we know where the money is coming from.
Yeah. Well, I also think that some of these trade organizations and I've unfortunately made myself quite unpopular in the livestock ag community by these opinions, but because at one point I was like you, I could flit back and forth between the two and everybody loved me and it was all good. But now, you know, not so much. But anyway, that doesn't mean that they don't still talk to me. It just means that I've come to think that organizations like the National Cattlemen's Beef Association or the Pork Producers Council, that they are not serving, and this is a little bit different from direct lobbying, but somehow, and maybe you can help me figure this out, there is something that they are not educating their constituents about the options, I don't think.
Right.
I think that there is a real bottleneck of information. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I totally agree. We Food Tank worked on a publication over the summer in collaboration with the Boston Foundation to basically a short report to give to funders and donors, foundations, investors on the need for investing in smaller and medium scale livestock production, because so many of them don't understand the risks that are involved.
Right.
But, you know, and I think, you know, if the National Cattlemen's would read that kind of publication, or if their members could, they would realize that there are other options out there, ones that are economically sustainable for their members, but, you know, don't have the same sort of environmental and social welfare costs. So I think, you know, absolutely, they're not doing a good job at educating their members about here's another way to do it, or here's several other ways to do it. It doesn't mean that all big livestock production is going to go away, although I probably like it to go away. But like, it does mean that these members of these associations have better options, that they can make the decisions. Because right now there's only one decision for them to make, because that's all they know.
Well, it's also all that they're, well, for instance, talk again about livestock, which is a particular interest of mine. the business is so consolidated now that unless they play ball with the big guys, they literally can't get their animals to slaughter and they can't get them distributed.
Absolutely.
And so that, I mean, to me, that's like the crucial issue for changing the livestock paradigm. And you know, even though the big companies are starting to pay more attention to and even to change some of their protocols, like, for example, last summer when Tyson announced they would no longer be injecting antibiotics into their eggs, you know, that was a huge concession on their part. And according to them, it took them 12 years to get to it. Now, the National Chicken Council, you know, again, citing this Harvard research paper, you know, says that really everybody who's worried about antibiotics in the food system has their undies in a bundle over basically a non-issue, which I found astonishing. But...
laughable, isn't it?
I mean, it was just like, it was like, I'm like, and so I said to the guy who wrote back to me, you know, from the Harvard study, I said, so you're saying that the World Health Organization, you know, the National Antimicrobial Research, you know, System, the, you know, CDC, Consumers Union, these guys are all like chasing the wrong problem? I mean, really? No response, as you might imagine. Anyway, are going to have, I am going to have somebody from that report come on and then maybe get somebody from National Chicken Council because they were the ones who put me onto it. Anyway, just to quickly, we only have like 2 or 3 minutes left and I just want to get to one more thing. And that again is about sort of economics. We are one of the biggest food producing systems in this, in the world. And so what are we learning from other? Oh, no. You know what? Let's scratch that question. I want to ask you this. When you think of a, because we do have to wrap it up. When you think of a successful food system, what does that look like? And be specific and concrete. I don't want to know about like, you know, food justice or like abstract concepts or not. I want concrete answers to, you know, how we solve this thing step by step. What are your top 5 answers to that?
I mean, I don't know if I have a top 5, but I think looking at agriculture as part of a landscape and not looking at it as a separate industry is the only way and the best way to make change. You know, agriculture doesn't, you know, just happen over here or over there. Right. It happens among all of us, and we're all part of it. We're all part of the food system. And if we can think about it in that sort of more holistic way, I think we can make a big effort to change things. I don't have, you know, my top 5. I think, you know, there's no one country, no one village, no one city that does this all right. But there are components. There's a recipe here. And it's, you know, it's recognizing the importance of family farmers. It's recognizing that we need more youth involved in all aspects of farming and agriculture, not just the production part. It's realizing the importance of women in the food system and understanding that they're producing nearly half of the world's food, and yet they don't have the same resources as male farmers, whether they live, again, in something here in Africa or the United States. They're discriminated in all over the world. So there's a lot of components and of this recipe for a better food system. You know, it's recognizing the waste and finding ways to prevent it. But, you know, no one country is doing it right, unfortunately. But I think the components are all there. We just need to put them in the right order, in the right sequence. Before I go, I also want to mention to your listeners that The Food Tank Summit is sold out both days, but we will be having a reception and dinner at Farmers, Fishers, Bakers. Joe Yonan, the food and dining editor at the Washington Post, will be speaking along with a chef and activist, Jose Andres. So I hope anyone who happens to be in the area could come down and celebrate with us. It'll be a Food Tank's birthday party.
Oh, great. And also, just to remind listeners that you, I think, will be streaming this. Is that right? You'll be streaming the conference?
Yes, they can find it on foodtank.com. Yes. Yeah. So they can find the link to the live stream on foodtank.com. We'll be streaming both days. We'll be showing videos in between sessions. So there will be a lot of rich content for people to be watching.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds fantastic. I'm so glad I'm going to be able to join you. I'm looking forward to meeting you. You're a most impressive person. And I wish you the greatest success, and I hope you feel better soon, honey.
Thank you. I'll see you next week.
Okay, take care, Danielle. Thank you again. And thanks to my sponsor, Tabard Inn, for sponsoring my program today. Thanks to Jack for engineering, as always. See you next week, folks. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.